Hello and welcome to another Conversations at the Summit, the no-nonsense, no-jargon podcast brought to you by Climb UK. On this episode, taking charge of the way that we learn and helping everyone reach their potential.
We've been quite successful. We now sell to over 800 universities and colleges in North America, and that's taken quite a long time to build up. We've built everything from here in Leeds and the UK. But we've only been able to do that, I think, because we've been part of the community over there and people know us and trust us. Being there and being present and forming personal relationships is so important.
Well, with us is the founder and CEO of Genio, Dave Tucker, and alongside him, my trusty sidekick, the gaffer of Climb, Gordon Bateman. Dave, let me take you back to when you first realised that the way that we learn, the way we're taught, doesn't really work for everyone.
There's actually several moments for me personally that have led to this, but I'll start with my own personal journey first. I was a pretty good student at school, to be honest, a very curious person still. And I think this is something I think we can all relate to, that our learning experiences at school do shape and mold what we think we're good at and what we think we're not good at. And those experiences are often molded and shaped by our teachers or the support we do or do not get in the end. I was one of those people who couldn't do languages, or at least that's what I thought. And French was by far and away my worst subject at school. In fact, everything else I was pretty good at. But French I just couldn't understand. And I think this is something that a lot of people experience with languages. They kind of say, well, I'm just not a language person. But of course, the truth is it's all learning and we can all do languages because we've spoken one, at least one, ourselves. And there was a particular moment when I had that realization when it wasn't me and that maybe there are other factors in it play. And that was one day when I was 15, I was year 10 at school and we had a supply teacher. And in that one lesson, I swear I felt I learned more than the previous 3+ years combined. So much so, in fact, that after the class finished, I went straight up to the supply teacher and just said, do you do private tutoring? Can you help me, please? And then I think I met up with her maybe 3, potentially 4 times after school, ultimately then getting an A at my GCSEs. But the time I spent with her was so energizing and exciting. I felt like I was learning so quickly. So much so, in fact, that even though my A-levels had nothing to do with languages, I'd kind of caught the bug and wanted to be able to speak a foreign language fluently. And there's not many options for that at degree level if you don't study a language at A-level. So I then ended up studying Japanese.
You went for a nice, easy option.
Yeah, why not? How hard could it be, right? But it was definitely that lesson as a young 15-year-old that it wasn't me, you know? It was my environment, it was my instruction, and that was a belief that I've taken with me, that we're not limited by what we believe we can achieve and that anyone can actually expand what's possible through learning.
I'm fascinated by you already linking the entrepreneurship with taking Japanese as a degree and seeing that through. Is that just the way the mind works? Is it a bloody-mindedness of I'm going to do this because... What do you think it was that you've already sort of linked those two things?
My experience learning Japanese was very formative for me, and I never thought I would be an entrepreneur, if I'm being honest. But obviously, when you look back, you see all the signs there, you know, selling plums I'd picked off the tree on the side of the road when I was like 8 years old, and setting up a tuck shop at school and selling that. And, you know, you do all of these things, but I'd never really felt like that was me. But there's certainly an element of once you have conviction in something, it doesn't really matter what gets in your way. Kind of every experience you have from that point onwards is just a part of your journey of like going in this direction. And I think that is a mindset entrepreneurs have. You kind of people talk a lot about failure. And a lot of the discourse around failure actually confused me for a long time because I never interpreted any single setback as a failure. It was part of the journey, part of the process. And I think that's just a mindset that I'd always carried with me and was very important for my degree. As you can imagine, joining a class with other people who already had studied Japanese and I hadn't. And so you very much feel like you're at the bottom and you have to climb and work your way up to the top. The other thing that I would say was very formative for me was the experience of living outside of my comfort zone. And as an entrepreneur, you just have to get used to that. I watched a Ben Horowitz video actually over the weekend, and he said the hardest thing about being a CEO of a startup is the fact that you have all of the responsibility and you need to make decisions, and these decisions are consequential, but you have no clue what you're doing. You can hire a team in and those people can be experienced, but you're not always going to see eye to eye. And then you also need to be able to manage those individuals. And you're just continually living out of your comfort zone.
Sometimes it's easy to forget from the inside when you're running around that you do need to be organized. So that natural ability you'd got when you were learning Japanese must be hugely valuable now as you're scaling a business at the rate you're scaling it.
I completely agree with that. How organized I am now, there's definitely room for improvement. I think the other thing that often goes hand in hand with entrepreneurship is creativity. Creativity, I think, ultimately stems from not putting the world in rigid boxes, but by seeing it as kind of a web of interconnected concepts and ideas and the ability to see connections where others might not, and to also develop your own perspective on how things work or what problems there are. Ultimately, it's a kind of problem-solving ability, but being able to be quite creative in that, combined with kind of the personal conviction and confidence to then bring it into reality. Or even sometimes I would say a sense of responsibility to bring that into reality as well, depending on the thing. But it is definitely true that with all of the demands of entrepreneurship, understanding what does your personal system look like? What are the things that you need to keep track of? What are the things that you need to stay on top of is really important. And, you know, the first thing that comes to mind with this are the operating systems that are out there for businesses once you reach the point of scaling. So you have the entrepreneur's operating system from the book Traction. You've got Scaling Up as well. And these are, again, those systems for how to think about your business and how to make sure those foundational components are in place so that you can turn the chaos, which is necessary at the beginning, right? And turn it into something a bit more ordered in order to then repeat, scale, and enable others to feel a real sense of, well, I was going to say accountability, but also a sense of their position, their role, and how it all connects to the bigger whole.
But you see, it's interesting from the outside world. I think sometimes when a company's growing really quickly, it just looks like chaos. And so some people coming with an entrepreneurial mindset to them is constantly chaotic. The most successful founders and entrepreneurs we meet and we interview here all have a system of one form or another, and they've worked out what that system is for them. So yes, we all have a vision and a destination. So it starts with that. A lack of fear, I think, because of confidence of failure. So you just think, well, I can find a way around it. And then the system in the background, I mean, people think I'm chaotic, but there is a system in the back. These are things every day or every week or every month that have to get done, regardless of what's happening. And either it's a natural inbuilt thing that you've got, or very quickly, if you want to scale, you've got to get someone next to you who can do that. But I think that natural thing you talk of, even from a young age, of working a system to allow you to do something is, to me, what looks insanely complex of learning a language like Japanese. Having that in the background must help you as you're going through new things and new experiences as you scale the business.
And the thing about these systems is it's not necessarily true that you sit down one day and have a piece of paper and document the system and then say, this is my system, this is how I'm going to implement it. Often you can more intuitively come to understand these are the most important things that I need to be doing and this is when I need to be doing them. That ultimately then does become a system for you. You can rely on your sense of this is very important, this needs to get done. I'd also agree that for myself personally, having that partner to assist with the organization has been essential to the growth of our company. And I think very, very hard to do everything by yourself and to be thinking super long term, thinking about things that are urgent right now, yeah. thinking about all of the details that's required in order to run a business well. And so having that complementary skill set with someone who intuitively thinks in terms of systems and organization and sees the value in consistency of sticking to that, even when, you know, the optimal thing might be to break that system. yeah. You know, that is one of the other tensions that you're always going to have in place. Are you doing what's absolutely optimal for the moment, or are you doing what's more sustainable long term? It takes a lot of experience to understand how to get that balance right. And so, especially as you're learning, having people that are different to you that can help provide that counterbalance, I think, is invaluable.
And we found statistically and anecdotally that founders who bring that person in either at the beginning or at a point stay in a CEO leadership role for much, much longer in the company's journey. You do get people who cycle startup, do a startup, get it to a certain stage, leave and do it again. They like the chaotic bit. But I totally agree that if someone had said to me 10 years ago, sit down and write down the system, it wouldn't be what it is now. And you're constantly evaluating, aren't you? You're constantly thinking, does that work? And then I do this in an evening, is look at this and go, no, I want to break it because that's who I am. And I want to break it because there's something right now, but in a week's time, that something will have gone. And I know this thing works. So that, again, is where having a partner, co-founder, a team, I guess, really, as you grow, becomes absolutely critical.
Completely agreed. And I think there's a number of reasons why that difference you meant, the early stage founder that just loves that early bit, the chaos, and then is very happy once you've got product market fit to kind of build a team and hand over and do something again. Yeah, I can relate to that quite a lot because it's so exciting. There's so much energy. You kind of have to succeed, right? And so there's a lot of adrenaline all the time. That's really exciting. But also that's the very thing that over a long period of time can lead to burnout. Yeah. And so those early stage founders, I think, might leave because they're burnt out and then they have a break and then I'm going to do it again using everything I've learned. And so that's kind of a bit of word of caution as well, mm-hmm. which is if you're someone who really is very passionate about the company you're building, the problem you're solving, the way you're solving that, your own well-being and being able to be sustainable and then go through the transitions as the business evolves. There's definitely clear stages. Once you've got problem solution fit, product market fit, you're then kind of moving on to this kind of customer building and then ultimately company building, right? And when you really want to scale up, if you want to be part of that journey, then you absolutely need to have that team around you to transition the way you work from kind of being the sole driving force and the person with the most context, the most intuition, the best ability to make decisions, for you to actually be none of those things yeah. and for your team to play that role. Yeah. And then as a leader, you take on a very different role. That's the journey I've been on myself. And I have to say, it's been really hard. It's been really hard to go through that journey.
What Genio is relatively new, isn't it? Where did it actually start? What was the first iteration? What was the first business?
Well, the very first moment where it started was in 2004, over 20 years ago. And the original product for our company, Audio Notetaker, was invented by my father. And he had the idea, again, back at my school that I went to when I was a young guy. We were at a student finance presentation and they spoke about a government funded scheme called the Disabled Students Allowance. And this still exists today. And if you're a individual with a disability in higher education in the UK, you can go for an assessment with an assessor who will assess you of your needs and then recommend accommodations. And many of those accommodations are technology. And back in 2004, about 80% of students would be given a laptop and assistive technology and a voice recorder. Now students are still being given software, including our own. And my father's background was as an engineer. He started off as an academic. He did a PhD, and actually his research went on to help contribute to voice over IP. He then ultimately spent 10 years at HP Labs in Bristol as a senior researcher with a specialism on speech engineering. initially involved in speech recognition. In the 90s, I think people started to realize that maybe this was a harder problem than it initially thought. Maybe it would take a bit longer before we're talking to our computers, which of course we are now, but back then the technology wasn't there. So he explored this idea of speech as data. How do we get more value from audio recordings if we're not turning it into text? What does that look like? And during that time, experimented with algorithms to visualize speech. And so it was this moment, again, at my sixth form, when he realized that this technology he'd been kind of exploring that had no real commercial use while he was at HP, actually could be very valuable for students who were neurodiverse, who were being given a digital voice recorder anyway to record their lectures. And if he could create a piece of software that accompanied those digital recorders, then, well, not only can we solve a problem for the students, but we've also got a business here. So that was the genesis of the organization. In February 2007, he launched the first version of Audio Notetaker. He taught himself to code in order to build it because he could do the C++ audio engineering components, but needed to understand how to build pieces of software. And he had a student at the University of Bristol as a summer project help him architect it. So that came to market February 2007. And all throughout my time at university from 2005, I supported him. I did market research, helped him find his kind of first partner, recorded my lectures, did surveys with students, and kind of never thought that I would actually go on to join him, although I then started spending summers shadowing him and working with him. But when I graduated in 2009, for various reasons, I didn't actually want to move to Japan after doing a degree. I was in a relationship at the time with someone in Leeds, and that was enough to make me want to stay. So I was looking for other options, and because I'd done work with my father over the years and had so much context and understanding, we said, well, why don't I continue doing that work? And so it was just me, him, and we had one developer at the time. I very quickly started just getting out of the building, right? I went to conferences. I started chatting to these assessors, and the ecosystem had trainers as well who trained students on the software they were being given. And I just started chatting to them. And the more I spoke, the more I heard about the challenges facing learners with dyslexia, with ADHD. And the more I realized that this idea my father had, this seemingly simple product that he'd created, was actually really powerful. I can remember really clearly conversations where people said, you know, you need to do more to get this out there. At the time, we had a partner who, it was a 50-50% relationship where they did the sales and marketing. They operated in that industry, in that market, and kind of we made the software. And the strong advice to me was, no, you should be doing the sales and marketing as well. I don't know if this other company really understands the true potential of what you've got here. And that kind of set me off with doing that. And the first step was to grow in that initial DSA market. And
DSA.
Disabled Students Allowance. Yeah. And there was this very pivotal moment in 2011. We actually have named one of our rooms in the office after it, Olympus. And Olympus refers to the Japanese company because they were the ones who made the digital recorders. And our software was an accompaniment to them. You actually just imported the recordings from that digital recorder into our software. And Olympus in 2011 decided to completely copy us and make their own version of the software with the same visualization. We were called Sonocent Audio Notetaker. They called it Sonority Audio Notebook. Marketing campaigns were very similar. And it was, you know, one of these moments where you feel like this is the worst possible thing that could have happened to us. Like, we're in such a vulnerable position. We have this giant with seemingly infinite resources. We've definitely felt like David in that moment. And it was this wake-up moment where I realized we can continue to be an accompaniment to this digital recorder. We also needed to be a lot more kind of vocal about who we were. We weren't this kind of faceless corporate giant. We were a small group of people that were personable, that really cared about what we were doing. And so that was the first time that started to come through in our branding and how we kind of showed up externally. But yeah, this vulnerability of being the accompaniment to digital recorders. But I just asked myself the question, it's like, well, audio note taker and being able to come back and listen to those recordings, easily navigate them, annotate them, organize them, ultimately take notes from them, that's actually a part of a broader learning process. And ultimately what we're doing is we're supporting learning and learners. And we've created this pretty unique interface for working with speech. But many students do struggle with fluent reading. You know, that is a friction point for them. So what if we enable students to be able to work as speech, be able to communicate their ideas by speaking into the software and then organizing them later? What if it was a product for brainstorming, for presentation practice, for all of these other study skills that we had a tool that could support them without having to rely on text as the default medium? But then also we needed to find another market for ourselves. And it wasn't immediately obvious that that would be continuing to support students with disabilities, because the challenges of learning were pretty ubiquitous. You know, we could be helping anyone, and we had a tool that was valuable and useful. And immediately we thought of language learning, actually, probably biased by my own experiences learning languages. And so we spent many years with numerous different partnerships, with vocational qualifications, with big publishers, with language schools. We tried it all, basically. But there was one opportunity that ultimately became a core part of our business, and that was selling into universities in North America, more specifically selling into their disability services departments. And this all came from actually just being in America and chatting to people. And I'd started going to conferences in America from the start of 2011, starting with assistive technology conferences, actually because we had an email from someone saying, where can I buy your software in America? And we said, well, where do you think you would buy it? And can we chat to them? We went over to America and started to learn a bit more about the US market. But it was in 2012 when I attended a conference in New Orleans in July. It's called the Association of Higher Education and Disability. It's essentially the industry group for disability services in higher education in America. And there's generally several thousand attendees that go. And of course, it being set in New Orleans, there's a lot of live events and live music to go to in the evenings. And I just got chatting to a guy in a bar casually, and it turned out we were at the same conference. And that's exciting. Turns out he'd heard of us. That's even more exciting. But it also turns out he was based in Madison, Wisconsin, which was the very city that our newly formed partners were based in. And we'd just set up an exclusive agreement with a distributor called Douglas Stewart. It was actually a strategic partnership where we will put some money into doing the market development. And he was based there. And I was like, well, this is great because I'll be in Madison quite a lot. I learned so much from him. He was so passionate about his students. He was so passionate about the challenge that they were facing. And he was so adamant that the existing ways of supporting those students were not sufficient.
Can I just pick you up on the whole US market thing? Is the US market and the way that you worked that US market and going around meeting people and going to the conventions and all of that, is it very different to here, where, you know, we've got an incredible event in Climb and everything, you get everybody together for 2 days, but is it a very different market over there that to a certain extent helped you to grow the business?
I can only speak to how we built the business in the US, but we've been quite successful. We now sell to over 800 universities and colleges in North America, and that's taken quite a long time to build up. But I would say it was very much a kind of community-driven approach. Remarkably, we still don't have any US employees. We've built everything from here in Leeds in the UK with kind of a pretty standard SaaS sales function. But we've only been able to do that, I think, because we've been part of the community over there and people know us and trust us as individuals, not just the brand or name of the company. And so I think that being there and being present and forming personal relationships is so important. I can't emphasize that enough, really. And or at least it was for me. I often half joke that our US business was built at the bar. And it is kind of true. And what did I do when I was over there? Well, I'd take every possible opportunity to meet people. And I would be the last one at the bar, because the people who go to the bars at these conferences are generally the people who are most networked, who get themselves out there. They seem to know everyone. And so you can have a conversation and you can then talk about matters that you both care about. And again, because we operate in education and learning and assistive technology, that's not that hard, right? You can talk about the students, you can talk about your products. And so you start to build those relationships over time. And that, I think, then enables you to start growing in those markets.
Gordon, I know you work with a lot of companies that we talk about internationalizing on this podcast at Climb and all the rest of it. And is that something that you tell people? You've got to get out there.
100%. Not just internationalizing. I think we in the UK as founders don't do it enough anyway. I think there isn't a natural place, a natural hangout where, you know, if you're in the US, it's not just at bars, it's at coffee shops or whatever. Entrepreneurs and business people will just interconnect. And I think we're lacking that culturally in the UK. We don't think to that. We sit at our desk. So I think we've just doing a lot of stuff here in department, actually, that we're using downstairs as being that natural place. So for years, the first couple of years of department,
we should possibly say we are in the cinema room of the office block, in which is a shared office space, isn't it?
But this is more than a shared office space now. So it is a community. So one of the things we launched at Climb and we announced at Climb was turning department into a place where it's a safe place where conversations like you just had can happen. The bar isn't like it used to be, where you just kind of go in and buy yourself a drink and sit. The new regime here is very much around interconnecting. It's almost taking a Climb journey. But so I think there's a cultural thing of people knowing to do that and not being afraid to do that, and then finding a destination where you can make that happen. And that is just more common in the US. It's almost expected. I think, as you said, David, is being out there, getting out there, it's not being at your desk. What I do love, though, as well, what you talked about, is you don't have to build everything there. You've kept it here. So I've sat in meetings with Department of Business and Trade and British Business Bank who have this fear of, oh, the company's going to leave and go to the States. I've never seen that in 30 years of working with businesses. You'd see occasionally because that's the right market for them. But usually when people expand to the US, they keep here, keep an element here. And so, but I think it is that being present and being in front of. I think that's a thing that business leaders, particularly at a startup level, everyone does it. They run around because you're in that hustling mode. You get to every event. As you get busy and you scale, there's a risk that you don't find the time to continue to do that. And you've done that exceptionally well, both here and internationally.
Yeah, and I think there's multiple reasons why it's so important for leaders to do that. Mm. I think I mentioned previously trust and that relationship building. And especially in a market like education, there's a bit of a fear, I guess, about corporates and kind of commercial entities. Maybe you wouldn't get that in other industries, but it is true that people do business with people, and you can have a well-respected brand, but ultimately it's the people that represent that brand is the interactions people will have, and that's really important as well. Yeah. And that's how you build a reputation. But the second thing I would say is, as a leader, there is so much to learn about a new market and a new country. And this is said ad nauseum that, you know, although we share a common language, the US and the UK are very different countries with different cultures, different ways of doing business. And indeed, each state in the US varies significantly about some of the norms. And so you can't really predict how different it's going to be, but you should definitely go in thinking what we do here in the UK is probably not going to work in the US. So we need to work out what is going to work. And that type of context and that kind of ability to make quick decisions once you have insights, once you have intuitions about something, and understanding, do we place a big bet? Do we place a small bet? What do those look like? It has to be the entrepreneur that goes out there and develops that understanding, or like senior leadership, depending on the scale of your business. But it is one of those things that is just as much about learning as it is about business development.
And we see so many people go on these trade delegations that look like, to me, business holidays, and they don't get embedded into the ecosystem, which is what you've done, actually having multiple conversations, hunting it out yourself, not just waiting for it to be given to you on a plate.
Absolutely. You know, it's network, right? Your network is your net worth. We're not talking about networking as in turning up to a networking event and collecting some business cards and email addresses or LinkedIn ads. That's not what this is about. This is about, you know, sharing bits of yourself with people, developing that real human connection, being invited for dinners with people because they want to have you around, you know, and suppliers as well. You know, yep. A lot of the time in the early years, it would be just as much building relationships with all the other companies operating in that industry, because guess what? They have so much knowledge and there's so much you can learn from them. And if you're not directly competing as well, you know, they will start to talk about you. They will start to say, oh, have you seen this product? What they're doing is pretty cool. You should check them out. And, you know, and that's kind of how it builds up.
Which leads us very nicely to Genio, which is where you have grown, you and the team have grown it to now.
So we launched Glean. It helped assist our growth as well. But we always knew that we were constrained and limited by the mechanisms by which people get our software. So very much in the UK and in the US or North America, students will have to request support. They will have to have already had a diagnosis for a disability. And then the institution or the assessor will have to recommend our software. And then the student has to decide to use it as well. And our vision is for every student to be set up for success from day one. You know, if the technology's there that can help support challenges, if we have the information on how to be a better learner, then surely that should be made available to any student at any time. Something like 65% of students who receive support for disability at high school do not even register with disability services when they get to college in the US. So that's already two-thirds of students that should be getting support are not getting support. But moreover, you know, we wanted to say, well, what is a true commitment to unlocking better learning for everyone? And it's not just lectures and it's not just note-taking. So becoming Genio is about becoming multi-product, about developing a suite of interconnected tools that help support various components of the study and learning process. So with the Genio announcement, we also announced a new product called Genio Present, which is a presentation rehearsal tool. It enables students to practice their presentations to help overcome anxiety, but also develop presentation skills as well. And we're also at the early stages of another product as well, related to learning support and study support. But it's also about saying we also want to support learners in other ways as well, through content that we produce, the resources of how to be a better learner, communities as well. We set up the Ambassador Program last year where we had 150 students from all around the world, different colleges, all users of our product, kind of come together as a single, tightly knit community to share experiences, to encourage each other, but also then commit to sharing their experiences with others as well through content they produce and put on social media or initiatives they run on their campus. Again, this network, this community, I think it's so important for individuals to believe in themselves as well when it comes to learning. A phrase I use often is, you don't run for a bus if you don't think you can catch it. But if you think you're going to make that bus, you'll sprint for it, right? And the same is true with learners and learning, and especially your experience at education. You might experience all this friction saying, ah, this isn't for me. I'm not cut out for this. Just like my experience learning French, you know, I'm just not going to be able to do this. But if learners can actually believe in themselves and have the confidence that it's worth putting the effort in, that's the thing that's ultimately going to make the difference. So this is what being Genio is about, kind of expanding to reach all students campus-wide, expanding the support we offer with new tools, but also new forms of support through communities and content.
You are clearly going places and going places fast. Absolutely fascinating. I think we could probably talk all day about it, but good luck.
Thank you very much.
Join us again for more conversations at the summit.